Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Hey guys, my guest today was a very early employee at Twitter, like so early that when he joined, there were only a few dozen people there. So really early employee at Twitter. He's also done a bunch of other things, including he once owned an auto repair shop. But the reason why he's actually on the show is he's got a new meditation app aimed at athletes called Lucid. His name is Jason Sterman. Here we go. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Welcome, man.
Hey, thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Here's the question I ask everybody. How and why did you start meditating?
Yep. So I was maybe into my second or third year at Twitter. And one of my good friends there, the lovely lady Michelle Gale, she invited me to attend a meditation class at Twitter. Now, I grew up in Texas. And the word meditation to me right away had some connotations that it was an Eastern religion thing. I thought it was something maybe you sit lotus style and levitate in a cave in Tibet or something. But almost as sad, I didn't want to tell her no, so I decided to go to this class. And
were you like interested in her or just,
no, not
okay,
at all.
Okay.
No,
you're married, right?
I'm married. Okay, yeah, okay. I married my high school sweetheart.
Okay, okay.
But she did some HR stuff at Twitter and
okay,
really,
it's not
really
like you were macking on her. It's
no,
just that you
no,
were
no.
Nice.
She actually came. She's now one of our best family friends.
Gotcha.
And,
okay.
But she was really interested in meditation, and she got me to go to this class. And I remember walking to the class really hesitant, thinking like, we have to change into robes or we have to understand some different language. I just had no idea what meditation was. And so I remember showing up and meeting the meditation teacher, and he was kind of a young, hip, white guy, kind of looked like me or someone who could be like me. And right away I noticed he had the most calm aura about him. It's just very warm and gentle and such a nice guy. I remember when he shook my hand, it seemed so authentic. And I remember thinking at that point, I don't know if meditation is what made him like this, but I want to be more like this guy.
Do you remember who it was?
I have no idea. No idea. I never saw him again.
Interesting.
That was my first taste, and he did a 30-minute guided meditation. I remember closing my eyes and breathing, and I remember about halfway through thinking, this isn't religious at all. This isn't spiritual. And I remember kind of at the end opening my eyes and feeling like, okay, that was something. Something happened there. I remember feeling calm afterwards. And I thought, you know what? I could maybe get into this.
And did you, from that moment on, pick up the habit, or were there some fits and starts?
Yep. No, didn't get into it right away. That class was offered maybe once a month or so at Twitter. And so I think I went two or three times and toward the end of my career at Twitter. And then when I left Twitter with Evan Williams to start what is now Medium.
Evan Williams is one of the founders of Twitter. And so you went with him to
start a new company after Twitter. Yep. And Ev had been really into meditation also. And so when we started Medium, we really agreed from day one that we wanted to have a really mindful culture at Medium. And part of that would be having in-house guided meditation. And so then he hooked us up with a guy named Will Kabat-Zinn, who's John Kabat-Zinn's son.
Yes,
and
yes.
So we started bringing Will into our company 3 days a week to do guided meditation, 30-minute guided meditation, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And when I started practicing with Will and got to spend some time with his father, John, and that's when I really started my own practice, and that was 5 years ago.
And what has it done to you, for you?
Sure, yeah. Gosh, a lot. I'll say it's been very transformative for me and my wife and my family. And even at the company we built at Medium, the company was very high functioning, high performing, but had this undertone of just calm and trust. And it was very human centric culture we built. And I credit a lot of that toward the meditation practice. And for me personally, you know, I was never really a super stressed out. I never acted out. I don't have any sort of, you know, mental disorder that I know about. But really came to find just a sense of calm and awareness in my life, and kind of a foundation that I could return to, and, you know, not worrying about what I think may happen in the future or dwell on some stupid mistake I made in the past. But just the ability to be here felt really powerful to me. And I felt like my days were longer. I felt like my senses were sharper. And I just really wasn't that stressed. Although I can say now, looking back prior to my meditation practice, I think I was a pretty stressed out individual and just it never manifests itself in super unhealthy ways. But looking back, I didn't live much of my life present until I was, maybe 33, 34 years old, and I started really meditating.
Better late than never.
Absolutely.
And earlier than I did, just for the record.
There you go. Gotcha.
So, what does your daily practice look like?
Yeah. So it's changed quite a bit. I've been through kind of different phases, and the first 2 or 3 years, I would sit with Will 3 days a week, and then I'd probably do 2 or 3 days a week by myself, either using an app like Headspace or Calm or Insight Timer or Buddha 5. Tried them all, and I like them all. And sometimes I just wake up early and just sit for about 30 minutes by myself and just breathe. And it sounds
simple. Mean, like when you say just breathe, but like pay attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and going out, and then when you get lost, start again?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. Just breathe in, breathe out, and let the thoughts come as they may, but try not to focus on them or hold on to them and let them go. And that practice was really invigorating for me. I found a definite correlation between when I practiced and my ability to focus and perform at a high level at work. And when I didn't, I just felt kind of a little bit in a cloud. And, it felt good. It transformed my performance at work and at home. But it was still somewhat laborious for me to get up and do it. I tell people, a lot of people ask, well, if it's so good, why don't you just do it all the time and every day? And it's kind of like going to the gym. Everyone knows going to the gym is going to make you healthier, but sometimes it's hard to get there. Everyone knows eating healthier is going to make you feel better, but sometimes you like sweets. So it's been somewhat hard for me to kind of keep a regular practice. So that's how it started. And then in the last year or so, I've really been doing 5 minutes a day, using Lucid, which maybe we'll talk about, which is
my
new app. Yeah. And in Lucid, we have two mental skills coaches who are both big believers in meditation. One is George Mumford, who's been on your show.
Yes.
And one's Graham Betchart, who's worked with a bunch of young athletes who are now up-and-coming NBA stars.
Yeah. And George Mumford, for those who didn't listen to the show, he worked with the Lakers and the Bulls, taught people like Kobe and Shaq and MJ. And so these are two very experienced teachers you have in your app.
That's right. In the athletic performance world, I think they're two of the best.
Yeah.
And they're both big into meditation. I know you talked to George and got to hear his story. It was an amazing story.
It's amazing.
And Graham has a similar one. And so now my practice looks like putting my headphones in and using my app. And for 5 minutes a day, listening to one of those guys guide me through what we call a mental skills workout. And part of the mental skills workout, there's a meditation component every day. And the audio and the mental skills workout is a little bit of meditation, some visualization, and some positive affirmation. We call it our MVP.
All in 5 minutes. And so that's all you're doing now?
That's all I'm doing. Well, most days that's all I'm doing. I now have some more awareness and I'm able to sense when I think I need to sit a little bit longer. Sometimes I'll go off into a little like nap room or break room at work and do 20, 30 minutes of sitting and breathing and just returning to the present. Or I still like to use apps like Headspace and Calm and to kind of get me there. But I've noticed that even 5 minutes a day, 5 or 6 days a week over, months and years can have a pretty significant effect.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. So are you no longer at Medium or are you full-time at Lucid?
I'm full-time at Lucid, yep. Okay. I left Medium after being there for 4 years, raised a little seed money, and started Lucid.
Great. Yeah. I know this very well as somebody who has a meditation app himself. This is a very crowded space. So why did you want to jump into it?
Yep.
And does it worry you that it's crowded? And how did you think Lucid was going to be different?
Sure. So really the genesis of Lucid started in some ways with George Mumford. My co-founder is a friend of George, and my co-founder has a conference in which George speaks at most every year.
You should name your co-founder.
His name's Soren Gordhammer, and he started a conference called Wisdom 2.0.
So Soren's a big figure, and he's a big dude. He's a tall dude. He's a big figure in sort of modern mindfulness movement, and he started this conference that's now all over the country called Wisdom 2.0. So they have New York, LA, San Francisco is the big one every year.
Yep.
And I think one in Hawaii, yeah. Maybe a few other things. So Soren will be on the show at some point. But anyway, so he's your partner and the two of you, he's friends with George. So the two of you
teamed
up.
So when I left Medium, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I know that I'd been in the online publishing space working with Ev Williams for almost a decade. And I was ready to kind of take on a new chapter in my life. So when I left Medium, I started to look at the things that were important to me, and I'm a tech startup guy through and through. I'd founded some companies prior to Twitter, then at Twitter and at Medium, and I just love tech startups, and so I'm a tech guy. I'm a sports junkie. I still play basketball 3 or 4 times a week and follow all my favorite teams and players closely, and meditation has become really transformative for me over the last 5 or 6 years, and so I sense there might be something at the intersection of these three. I had no idea what it looked like, and I started talking with Soren, who I had gotten to know. I'd been on some meditation retreats with him, and he had heard, actually through our friend Michelle Gale at Twitter, who's also friends with him, he had heard that I had left Medium, and he had had this idea for some software to support the Wisdom 2.0 community outside the conferences, and so he heard I was available, so he called me up and wanted to bounce some ideas off me, and I was looking for something to do, so we started talking about technology and mindfulness. You know, it's a real big passion of Soren's and mine now, and we started looking at the landscape and definitely had no desire to build another Headspace or build another Calm. I think you're right. I think the space is really crowded. But part of the conversations always started talking about mindfulness for athletic performance. There'd been some research done showing that even a small meditative practice can have a pretty significant effect on the court or on the field or the horse or the pool or however you choose to perform. And so I was really interested in that. I've always been really interested in the peak performance and things like this. And me and Soren started talking about it. And he said, we should really talk to this George Mumford guy. Soren explained how he brought George into his home to teach his son and his son's basketball team meditation. And he said the most amazing thing happened. He said, this is down in Santa Cruz in California. And he said George showed up and he invited these basketball players. And before he knew it, he had a house full of these young, mostly African-American basketball players who would have never shown up. They probably wouldn't have shown up for the Dalai Lama. But they showed up to meet the guy who taught Jordan and Kobe their competitive advantage. And so that's when something clicked for Soren, that I think we can reach athletes in a way that a Headspace or a Calm can't. Mm. And so I started talking to George, and George told me his amazing story. And he explained that he's been doing this work for almost 30 years now. And he said really only in the last few years have the elite athletes that he's been working with been able to kind of point to him as their competitive advantage. And he says that's happened for a couple reasons. One, there's this mindfulness trend that's happening. So it's becoming more accessible to talk about publicly when you're working on, you know, the organ between your ears.
Right.
And
it was embarrassing for a long time.
Yeah.
Even when I first started getting into it, like 2009, 2010, it was like kind of embarrassing.
For sure. For sure. And, you know, I remember, you know, George did a lot of work with Phil Jackson. Phil Jackson, they call him the Zen master, but it was almost in a satirical kind of jokey way.
Yes.
Now it's something that athletes are starting to become proud of. And so they point to George and say, this is the guy that taught me what I knew. And coupled with that, the science behind what happens to your brain, which I'm sure you're familiar with when you have a meditative practice, there's overwhelming evidence now that shows that a mindful or meditative practice can have a real significant effect on the physical makeup of your brain, which controls your body. And so the science behind it has allowed some athletes to kind of buy in and believe in it more. And so when George was telling us the story, and he was saying, now that he says he's out of the closet now, what he does, because athletes can talk about it. So he said his phone's ringing off the hook, because if you're a professional athlete, you want the same competitive advantage that Jordan or Kobe or Shaq or, you know, these Olympians that he worked with had. But George is on staff with the Knicks now, because he works with Phil Jackson still, and Phil's the GM over there, and does some work at Boston College, and he's getting older and he doesn't want to travel as much. And so when he's telling us a story, it kind of clicked to me. I think we could use technology to scale the wisdom in George's head to a much bigger, broader global audience, specifically collegiate and high school and youth athletes who aren't being reached by the Headspace and Calms and the Dalai Lamas of the world, but have this desire to be better at their sport and want that competitive advantage to be great like a Kobe or Jordan.
So I want to talk about how the app actually works and what's in there and all that stuff. But just a quick question. When I picked you up in the lobby to come up here into our radio studio to do this interview, you were saying that you were in New York. You live in San Francisco.
That's right.
You were in New York doing some fundraising for the company.
Yep.
Looking for venture capital money. I am new to this game myself of like talking to venture capitalists and building a business. And the thing that venture capitalists want to hear is, how does it become a $1 billion company?
Sure.
I have like no idea how to answer that. That's why I have people around me who actually know something about business.
Right.
But what is your answer to that? How does, is this a big enough market to target that it becomes a $1 billion company?
Yeah. So the way we're positioning Lucid is not another meditation app. We're positioning Lucid as a mental skills training app for athletes. And it may be surprising, but there's nothing out there like what we're doing. and the Headspaces and Calms of the world, they're starting to sense that there could be an opportunity to work with athletes, but they already kind of have a DNA and a profile in the world that isn't currently connecting with the demographic that we're targeting. And so when a venture capital asked me, you know, how's this going to be a $1 billion business? One simple answer is in the U.S. alone, there's about 36 million youth athletes. And by our estimation, basically 0% of them have access to this sort of training. So we have a business model in the app right now. It's a membership service, $10 a month to train with us through our app and work with George Mumfords and Graham Betcharts of the world. And that's going extremely well. However, we seem to be attracting a new breed of investor, and specifically venture capital investor, that are really looking to do something good in the world. And so we're finding some investors that really believe in mindfulness and meditation and understand that we've crafted a product that's reaching a demographic that is not currently being reached. So the investors I get really excited about talking with are the investors where we can think about in 10 years when a whole new generation of young athletes is emerging and becoming the role models that the next generation is looking up to, you know, what will the mindful athlete look like? And we're starting to see some models of that, but that's the thing that's really the driving force behind Lucid. And in fact, when I meet with an investor now that just wants to hammer me on, you know, engagement and business model and all this other stuff, it's, for me, it's an indication like, I don't think you're the right partner for us. And it turns out there's some very notable investors that not only want to get in this space because, you know, Headspace and Calm are doing significantly well business-wise, but they really want to do something good in the world, and they think that Lucid is a way they can push this movement forward in a way that's not currently being pushed.
Yeah, well, I mean, I almost want to give you money after listening to you talk, you know, because you're right, these are young athletes are people who are not being reached by this message of, hey, you can train your mind to make it, as George says, zone ready.
That's
and
right.
And given the outsized emotional role that athletes have in our culture, role model, the position of being role model locally, nationally, regionally, that if you have all these young people who are out there, you know, modeling these skills of mental fitness, that could have an enormous like multi-generational effect. So that's very cool.
Yeah, that's what we believe in. And we're already starting to work with some elite athletes in the NFL and the NBA that are the role models for, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of kids. And they're starting to talk about this, starting to talk about Lucid, and we're starting to see the effect it has on the athletes they influence. And we're also working with individual little high schools, little organizations. And what we found is that when kids start using Lucid and start performing better, they also start acting a little bit different.
Yeah.
They start being okay with failure a little bit more. They start exhibiting self-compassion and empathy and all these things that are life skills that go far beyond, you know, the athletic performance. But what we found is those personality traits are somewhat attractive. You know, confidence is attractive.
Yeah.
And we say that Lucid really helps build your confidence and focus. And once athletes start using Lucid and start exhibiting some confidence and performing better, we found that the other players on the team are like, what's going on with you?
Yeah.
What are you doing? And,
yeah.
And Lucid is an answer to that question sometimes. And more importantly, when parents of other kids see how some kids are acting once they start training with Lucid, it has a real riveting effect on the surrounding community and environment. And I feel like we're doing something good in the world, and it's spreading in that way, and that's exciting for us.
So I mean, like, you know, grown-ups talk a lot, or especially in the meditation world, you hear a lot about mindfulness or emotional regulation, whatever. But really, for athletes, it's more about not losing it.
Yeah.
And people who can keep it together, that is, I mean, that comes off as cool and confident.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what we know from George's work over the last 30 years and Graham's work over the last 10 years is that training your mind can have some really quantifiable, trackable performance on resulting performance on the court or the field. And so one of the things we like to talk about with our athletes is a concept we call next play speed. And the ability to be in the middle of a play and it go either really well or really poorly, and how quickly can you move on to the next play? And this is something that we really believe that learning how to meditate and learn how to be in the present is kind of the foundation for this skill. And so you can watch an NBA game and you can see a player shoot a three-pointer. As soon as the ball leaves his hand, usually they're kind of watching it. If it bounces off the back of the rim, a lot of times you'll see the players, like, they sulk for a second. Their head goes down. Their shoulders go down. They curse themselves. You can see them being hard on themselves. Yeah. And then you can watch them, and you can count one, two, three. And then you can see at what point their head snaps back up, and they're back in the game. And then once your head snaps back up, then it takes another couple of seconds to understand what's changed on the court or the field while you were out of it for just a couple of seconds. A couple of seconds on a basketball court, that's, you know, there's lots of moving pieces that have changed. So that takes a couple more seconds to kind of reassimilate yourself with the court and then know where to go. And so we believe that having a real strong meditative practice and really channeling your ability to be in the present helps you reduce your next play speed to as close to zero as possible. And so what that manifests itself is when you release a player releases the ball, shoots a three-pointer, a mature, mentally strong player will realize at that moment he or she has no control over whether the ball goes in or not. And so the best thing to do is don't worry about that and worry about what you should be worrying about, which is the next play. And so you can watch a guy like Steph Curry is a great example of this. You see Steph launch a three-pointer, and, well, he's so good, he might already be taunting you before the ball goes in. But you can see as soon as he lets go, he's already surveying for where he should go next. As opposed, you can look at some younger players in the league who clearly aren't as mentally tough as a guy like Steph, or Aaron Gordon is a guy that's a really mentally tough guy. And you can see they watch the ball, they sulk, and you can almost start to read when they're present in the game and when they're not. And what George would say is that being in the zone is really about just being present. And for players that have experienced that, like, I'm in the zone, they feel like time slows down. And I feel like the game kind of comes to them. And what we know is the real secret there is the ability to be present. And the way to be present, train your ability to be present, is through meditation.
So how does the app work? What if I open it up, what do I get? What do I see?
Yep. So it's super simple. You open it up, you put your headphones in, there's a big play button in the middle, and you hit play. Every day there's a new 5-minute workout for you. And the 5 minutes are usually structured with a little story or anecdote or some wisdom from George or from Graham. And then we go into what we call our MVP. And this is where we actually do
all audio, no video.
All audio right now. Yeah. Yep. We have some video coming soon. One thing that we found is that when we show young athletes, guys like Aaron Gordon, like, meditating before a game, it can start to normalize it for them in a way that we think is going to really help push this forward. But it's currently all audio. You get a little bit of wisdom, maybe a cool little story, and then we do our MVP, which is how we train, which is meditation, visualization, and positive affirmation. And so it's a couple minutes of sitting and breathing and returning to the breath and training that ability to become present. And then visualization is not sports specific right now, but we have kids imagining performing really well or imagining performing really poorly and starting to be aware of the feelings wrapped around those, the successes or failures. And then we can help them learn how to be aware of those in real time during a game. And then positive affirmation. One thing that both George and Graham have found working with youth athletes is negative self-talk is really inhibits youth athletes from performing, probably professional athletes also. But when you have young kids that, you know, I mean, I grew up playing basketball, and I always told myself I'm just I'm the slow, skinny white guy who just shoots threes. And that's what I'm telling myself about myself. All I'm ever going to be is a slow, skinny white guy shooting threes. And so we have a whole list of positive affirmations that we have our athletes kind of repeat to themselves in their head toward the end of the practice. And then the last, like, 30 seconds is congratulations, you showed up, you did it today, you should feel good about that, and show up and do it again tomorrow.
How are the positive affirmations, do you run the risk of being a little hokey there?
I don't think so. The way that the practices are, I realize the word positive affirmation, I kind of think of, what's that guy on Saturday Night Live?
Stuart Smalley.
I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. That's not how our affirmations sound in the app. And our affirmations are coming from, you know, the Graham Betchars and George Mumfords. They're coming from respectable, credible figures. And they use terminology that athletes understand. They almost embody kind of a coach's attitude talking to an athlete. And, when you have athletes repeating to themselves that, like, it's okay to fail, you know, things like that. Like, that doesn't have any of the hokey Stuart Smalley connotation to it. But having an athlete say it to himself over and over again and starting to believe that is a pretty powerful concept.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
One more question about the business, because I think about this a lot, the meditation business. Which some people have, by the way, mixed feelings about, that, you know, that you should be a business. And I, you know, as somebody who, you know, considers himself a Buddhist, it's an interesting thing.
Yep.
But anyway, here I am. Here we both are in this business. Do you think is the meditation instruction slash technology, you know, whether it's through apps or other technology or even, you know, in-person trainings too, is this like Uber? Where there's going to be Uber and then like Lyft and others just like way, way behind and trying to sell themselves unsuccessfully? Or is it going to be like fast food where you have a finite number, but like not just one number of big brands?
Yep. I think it'll be closer to the latter. And the reason I believe that is because you can look at I think Headspace is probably the predominant, most popular app right
now.
Well,
the first mover, and they're great.
They're a great team, and we know Andy over there, and we really believe in the work he's doing. And but we know when we look at our athletic demographic, like they're not connecting with Headspace.
Yeah.
And I also know some people that are not athletes, want to get into meditation, but for whatever reason, the Headspace brand and Andy's voice in the app just doesn't resonate with them for some reason. And so, you know, in the same way that, you know, spiritual people kind of gravitate toward a religion that kind of resonates with them, I think there's the opportunity for several Headspaces, although I don't think it's something that becomes hundreds or thousands. I think there will be, you know, a small handful of leading brands in this space. I hope Lucid becomes a brand for mindfulness for athletic performance. But I think
I can really see it. I mean, I can see. Look, I don't know anything, just to be clear. But I can really see. I mean, just listening to you talk about the business, it sounds awesome.
Well, I think we stumbled into something that we only launched the app 2 months ago, so we're very early.
Yeah.
But we are getting emails almost daily from young athletes, parents, coaches, and professional athletes that are telling us about some really transformative things happening both on and off the field. And for me, that's incredibly validating. And as proud as I am of the work that we did at Twitter early on and grew that system, and now at Medium is growing and becoming a more important system to publish thoughts and ideas in the world, I've never felt like the nugget of the offering at Lucid just feels so resonant and powerful in the world. And it's a very like human-centric level. You know, we're hearing from parents that say their young daughter would have panic attacks before, you know, going to perform her ballet on the stage or something. And she heard about Lucid, and after only a couple of weeks, she's learned how to take a few minutes to breathe before she performs and kind of get grounded. And not only did she dancing better on stage, but when she messes up, she's okay with it. And, you know, I have parents, you know, calling me in tears sometimes, just saying this is incredibly powerful. So I feel like we opened the door to a little mindfulness drug in a specific community, and it's really spreading and working well. And so I'm really excited to see where this goes.
Bravo, me too. let me torture you specifically for a minute here,
okay.
Because I read some articles about you, and there were some things in there that were really, really interesting, and I think kind of connect in a way to mindfulness and its twin skill of compassion.
Yep.
So there was a big article about you and this thing called Holacracy.
That's right.
which was a management-free technique that you or structure that you guys tried to use at Medium.
That's right.
first of all, what is Medium for those of us who sure. may not know much about it? And second, how did this? What is Holacracy and how does it work?
Sure. So Medium is a new publishing platform from one of the founders of Twitter. And it's a publisher of stories and ideas in the world that are longer than 140 characters. And it's a beautiful publishing platform. It's a network of people that love reading longer form stuff. And it's growing rapidly. And a lot of old publications are moving all their content over to Medium. It's just a better system. And so that's what Medium is, a place to share your stories and ideas in the world, which is the third chapter of Ev Williams' mission in life. He did Blogger, helped people, kind of invented blogging, let people write their thoughts and ideas down on the internet, which was a new concept 15 years ago. Then he did Twitter, which I assume most of your listeners have at least mm-hmm. heard of. Mm-hmm. And Medium is the next chapter in his mission to really facilitate the exchange of stories and ideas in the world. And so we started Medium, and there was only a handful of us, five or six of us, and we grew to six, seven, or eight. And we realized that we need some sort of structure in a company, like any company does. And to Ev's credit, he's always attracted to shiny new ways to perform better, which I think is one of the reasons he got into meditation, because it was, you know, pitched to him as a way he could function at a higher level, and that proved true. And he had a friend that was running a company and adopted this crazy system called Holacracy. And Ev's friend explained to him that they adopted this new system in their company, and it changed everything for them. And they'll never go back to a traditional hierarchy of people with middle management, and the way they operate is super fluid, and everyone is very autonomous and making a decision, and they're kind of just kicking ass. And so Ev said, well, that sounds pretty amazing, so let's check it out. So Ev and I did some research on Holacracy, and it turns out it was founded in Pennsylvania maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and by a software developer who was really into how organizations are structured, how they run, how they make decisions, how can perform at a higher level. And so the founders came down and did what we called a taster day, where they kind of gave us a taste of what Holacracy is. And we said, you know what, this seems really compelling, and we're going to try it. It's I call it a crazy system because it kind of is. And it gets touted in the media as a manager-less system, which is not a fair portrayal.
Oh, but I kept saying that, so that's I was okay. being unfair.
Well, I think that's the number one misconception about Holacracy.
Oh, okay.
And there is no role in Holacracy called manager. So that is true.
Okay.
Whereas most companies have something called a manager.
Right.
But there are roles.
I have like 18 of them.
There you go. There are roles in a holocratic organization that very much look and function like a managerial role, but they're not called managers. And so the idea of Holacracy is...
So you still have a boss.
You still have a boss. In fact, you have multiple bosses in most situations. It's a non-hierarchical system of getting work done in an organization. And what it really promotes is a high degree of autonomy. So you want to distribute decision-making authority as far down the tree as possible. And now this is much different than most organizations. Most organizations are hierarchies in which the power resides at the top, and at the bottom, there's not much decision-making authority. In fact, if a decision has to be made at the bottom of this tree, usually it has to go up through the channels to someone at, you know, upper management or executive level, and it has to go back down through the channels once a decision is made. And usually the people at the top don't have as much information as the people at the bottom who need the decision made. And so Holacracy tries to distribute that decision-making authority as widely as possible, which takes a pretty innovative, progressive guy like Ev Williams to say, you know what, I've made an unbelievable career of knowing how to build products and grow companies and run them well, but we're going to try something different. Instead of all the decisions kind of getting bottlenecked at my level, we're going to let kind of everyone in the company just kind of make their own decisions and run fast and trust we don't crashes okay. car we're driving.
But this seems like a recipe for chaos. Like, I'm just going to give you a tiny little example recently from within ABC News. I was supposed to go to Africa for 2 weeks for work, for a shoot. And so it was kind of planned, and I work for Nightline, but I also work for Weekend GMA, and so I had to get the heads of both of those shows to be okay with it. We had to work on the budget. I had to get it okay with my wife, but that's, I guess, sort of extracurricular.
Right.
And then kind of toward the end of it, I also have to get it okayed by the people who deal with all of where the various news anchors are at any given time.
Right.
Because we always need to have people nearby just in case, like, George Stephanopoulos is sick. Maybe I need to fill in for him or whatever, or right. he's going to take a vacation. So somebody is, like, looking at that.
Right.
And – So we were pretty far along, and then the decision got kicked up to the boss of ABC News, and he was like, actually, I think this is a bad time for Dan to be away for a variety of reasons.
Yep.
Totally legit reasons.
Sure.
All of which to say, had people lower down been empowered to just make that decision, we might have gotten to Labor Day and the manager, or whatever you want to call it, would have been like, where's Harris?
Right.
So that's just one tiny example. Weren't there lots of moments where Ev was like, wait a minute, you did what?
Yeah, absolutely. And so a couple points. One, Holacracy gives you the ability to be very explicit about who can make which decisions. So Ev could say, in my organization, I want Dan to be able to plan his own travel, and he's going to be called all over the world, do some news stories, and I want it to be okay for him to make that decision, full well knowing that he may not always make the best decision, but we'll learn. And then if he makes a bad decision, that'll be learning for us, and we'll be more robust because of it. We'll put up some guardrails so he doesn't crash the car in the same way.
Gotcha.
This holocratic system allows you to say, you know what, for this kind of decision, we actually need a pretty robust process, and this is the process we're going to put in place. And so Holacracy doesn't really dictate, doesn't prescribe how to make decisions, but it gives you a tool set to let you build a system around decision making that allows you to be on one and highly autonomous and let anyone make any sort of decision with rules or constraints you put in place. Or for some decisions, there could be a really robust, complicated process that has to go through. But one of kind of the core tenets is when you described everyone who needed to sign off before you went to Africa. One way you could be looking at that is like kind of consensus building. You have to look around and get everyone to kind of chime in and say, okay. And what the founders of Holacracy would argue is that consensus building is usually a lot of wasted time and effort to make. It might be better just to make a decision, and hopefully if it's a good one, it's a bad one, you'll learn from it and you won't make it again.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, I don't know if it's wasted time or effort, but it's a lot of time and effort. Either sure. I don't want to make a judgment on it. But I read that Medium has now abandoned Holacracy as it's gotten bigger.
That's right.
So does that say that the this principle does not scale?
I don't think it's about scaling. I'll say the reason that Holacracy didn't work. I'll say Holacracy worked at Medium and they learned a lot. And even after I left, they're still practicing a lot of holocratic-like practices at Medium. For example, one of the things with Holacracy is the meeting structure is there's a very strict structure around how you have meetings. It works incredibly well.
Meaning everybody gets to weigh in.
Yeah, everyone has a chance to be heard on certain things, but they move very fast and you get a lot done and you optimize for the output of the meeting. And that was a tremendous aspect of Holacracy that they still adopt at Medium. But what we found was as we were growing and we started growing fast and adding people to the team every week, when you start a new job, you already come in with some anxiety. You know, it's like, where am I going to sit? Who am I going to have lunch with? How am I going to impress my boss? And you know, people kind of come in with some nervousness and anxiety. That's just because we're humans and we join a new organization. And when you throw on top of that, that all still exists because you're new to this organization. And we have this system of structuring and running a company that's you've never heard of before. It's very complicated. The rules of the Holacracy game that we play exist in like a 30 or 40 page constitution, which reads like a legal contract. So you slap that on their desk and say, here's a system we use. Don't worry about it. You'll get to learn it. But it really affects how employees operate day to day. And so we found that there was a real big anxiety spike when new people joined. And a lot of new people, mature engineers and designers, they were attracted to a new and better system, but it was still caused a big anxiety spike. And then most recently, Zappos was the biggest company to adopt Holacracy, and that they made some kind of ripples in the press about this new structure that a big company was adopting. Prior to Zappos, Medium was the biggest and most notable company to have done it. And so as we were hiring tech people in Silicon Valley, the word got out that we had this other system, and it became just a conversation we had to have all the time. I think.
Oh, yeah, because you gave me a look when I said I was going to bring it up, like, oh, man, you're going to talk about that?
Well, I probably did, because it's incredibly hard to talk about because it's incredibly complicated. And that's ultimately the reason that
you did a good job of not getting overly arcane, and, but giving me a sense of it.
Okay, well, I've done this multiple times as we hired at Medium, but really, even the things that I just explained to you are really scratching the surface of what holacracy is. So it's a very complicated system, and that complication, when it's how you literally structure and run your company, there's a huge onboarding tax you have to pay to get someone up and running in the new system, and then there's this persistent tax that you kind of have to keep working and relearning and putting into practice and readjusting, and that ever-present tax has started to really weigh heavily on the organization, especially as we scaled from, you know, 5 people to 100 people, and you know, a couple years, a good portion of those 100 were really new to this, so it did create a lot of questions and not chaos, but it would have been a lot easier had we said we're just a traditional organization like every other organization you've seen. Now let's get to work.
So I guess the reason why I wanted to talk about it is not that I'm interested in the minutiae of management theory,
sure,
but because there seemed to be an emotional component to it, because as I've read, you did not like being a manager.
Yeah.
There was something about treating people as resources that struck you as wrong.
That's right. So I was
at Twitter.
At Twitter, yeah. And when we heard about Holacracy at Medium, I was really drawn to it because it had a very human element to it. And so when I was at Twitter, I managed some teams, and I, being always into peak performance and wanting to connect with people, I was reading all the, you know, management books. A lot of my mentors were helping me kind of become a better manager in a traditional sense of the word. And when you think about a high output management, you can look at your team and view them as like resources. In fact, like the term human resources, I hate it because it's like a resource is like a coal mine, you know, which you're trying to extract some
timber.
Valuable resource. Right. And, you know, I look at my team at Twitter, and I'm incapable of looking at them as resources. Yes, they have to be productive for my team to be successful, but they're human beings with families and stresses and emotions. And I felt like the more I attended to them as humans and less as, you know, machines that could output something of value, the higher functioning my team would be.
And did that actually work, or was it nice cotton candy? Sort
of? Always worked.
Really?
Always worked.
In fact, measurably.
My team at Twitter was often touted as one of the highest performing teams and one of the happiest.
What did your team do?
So we built internal tools at Twitter. So we built software for everyone else internally at Twitter to make their job easier, automate what they're doing, or make their life easier. And so, so when I really tended to the humans on my team, I feel like that's when we performed at a really high level. And so when, you know, fast forward 2 or 3 years and I hear about this Holacracy system, and it just had a real strong acknowledgement that an organization is made up of humans, not robots. And that really resonated with me. And how that manifests itself in the company is, I'll give you one example. One of the things that Holacracy teaches is how to understand you might have a tension at work and how to process your tension. And so the way Holacracy defines tension is not necessarily a negative thing. It doesn't mean like I'm stressed out and I'm about to crack. It means I realize there's a difference in what is and what could be. And there's a tension there. So tension could be I have this amazing idea and I don't know what to do with it. That's a tension. Tension could be I hate my coworkers. That's also a tension. And tension could be I'm not happy with the product we built. And so Holacracy gives you this language called tensions, where you go to this meeting, which is quite literally a tension processing meeting. And everyone has the ability to put their tensions on the table. And then the meetings are facilitated by a facilitator who, as quickly as possible, resolves all of the tensions. And this is where the meeting structure gets really important, because say we have 8 people in this meeting. We have an hour. We go through and we list all of our tensions. And it's not unusual to get maybe 20 tensions on the table, maybe sometimes even 30. And the facilitator has to resolve every tension before the meeting is up. That is the rule of the meeting. Hmm. And so to resolve a tension, it doesn't mean, in Holacracy, it doesn't mean that you find the optimal solution. It doesn't mean that the tension no longer exists, but it means as quickly as possible you identify a next step.
A road forward.
Yeah. And as soon as you identify that next step, that tension is resolved for the time being, and you move on to the next one. And a couple of things that relate to meditation and mindfulness here. To acknowledge a tension at work is a very mindful thing. To be able to step back and think, I'm feeling stressed, or I'm feeling like my shoulders are at my ears, or something's not right. What is it that's making me feel this way? You know, I think without having a culture rooted in meditation and mindfulness, it would be easy just to plow through those things or try to brute force your way out of that feeling. But to be able to just sit back and take a breath and kind of think like, what is it that's really bothering me here? And realize what your tension is, and then bring it to a meeting where there's a system in place to resolve your tension is a very human thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it what it caused at Medium was an incredible level of trust and respect and transparency and vulnerability at the company, which I think are those are all the human elements that I think we really did good of nurturing at Medium, mm-hmm. which caused us to perform better. When you trust your coworkers, it turns out you can move a little bit faster and make some riskier decisions. And so I really got to see the effect of this really human-centric organization on a really high-performing tech team in Silicon Valley.
But you're not using Holacracy at Lucid.
That's right.
Maybe some of the components of it, but not the actual
absolutely.
Strict.
Absolutely.
But before we go, you've been very patient with me, and this has been super interesting. But I want to just get you to explain this little fun fact that you owned an auto repair shop.
I did.
Why? Nothing against auto repair. I just didn't think that that would be in your wheelhouse.
It is not in my wheelhouse. Okay. In fact, to this day, I can barely open the hood of my own car.
Okay.
If I do open the hood of my own car, I definitely can't tell you what's underneath it.
So what were you doing?
I was coming out of a time where I had been doing some freelance coding and design work.
This is pre-Twitter.
Pre-Twitter. I was in Texas. I always had kind of an entrepreneurial kind of itch that I needed to scratch. And so I was always kind of making things in the world and playing with different ideas. And my dad had a friend who ran this auto repair shop, and he was looking to sell it. And he had a deal, and the deal was about to get closed. And right before the deal closed, the whole deal fell through. Well, my dad's friend had already moved on and started a next business. And so there was this shop that was kind of looking for someone to come in and run it. And so I remember my dad came to me and he said, you know, I know you have an entrepreneurial spirit. You always talk about running a small business. Here's an opportunity for you to run a small business. And I said, yeah, but I have no idea how to fix a car. And so I said, I know, but we had another friend that had run a shop, was currently running a shop and looking for a new location. So I went in kind of 50-50 with this guy. Mm-hmm. Well, right after we did that, the auto industry stopped doing so well, and people were buying new cars, not fixing their old cars. And my partner had to really maintain his shop. And so he kind of left me stranded at my shop. And so here I was, maybe 23, 24 years old, sitting behind the desk running an auto shop where people come into these things already kind of like their guards up.
Pissed.
Like they're combative.
Yeah, your car's not working.
And they come in, and this is in Texas where these guys are these, you know, bringing their big trucks, and, you know, how much to fix the medulla oblongata on my 4x4. And most times I literally had no idea what they were asking me. And so I had to kind of put on this face like, let me go check. I lasted at the shop for about a year.
Oh, and that's pretty good.
And I will say, it's a horrible idea to own a business in which you have no industry knowledge.
Okay,
that's a big learning.
Yes.
However, that year I think taught me more about running a business than anything I ever could have learned in any sort of MBA program or business school. And you know, I was the owner, the salesman. I ended up changing tires and changing oil and doing the finances and showing up at 5 a.m. to make sure the bathrooms were clean for the customer. And, you know, that was, I've always been a pretty happy, optimistic, cheery guy. And that year of my life, I like to describe as the dark ages. That was not a happy time for me, but sometimes it takes being uncomfortable to really learn and grow.
I think that's absolutely true. And it certainly applies to meditation.
Sure.
Jason, thank you very much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
People who want to get Lucid, where can they do it?
GetLucid.com.
GetLucid.com.
GetLucid.com. Yeah, okay. Check it out.
All right, there's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you like it, I'm going to hit you up for a favor. Please subscribe to it, review it, and rate it. I want to also thank the people who produce this podcast, Josh Cohan, Lauren Efron, Sarah Amos, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. And hit me up at Twitter, Dan B. Harris. See you next time.
If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Once upon a beat,
Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now, I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, The Competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully, no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.